Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. Excuse me. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Grant Heading, and on behalf of the Press Club Committee, I'd like to welcome you to our final luncheon of the year, and thanks to many of you for your support through 2011. Today's function takes on a different format. We'll hear from not one, but three speakers. Premier Jay Weatherill will join us a little later to speak about a major initiative stemming from a workshop the government hosted last week focused on determinants in health. We'll then hear from two of the world's most eminent health professionals who attended the course, Professor Ilona Kickbush, an independent global health consultant based in Switzerland, who spent some time here a few years ago as a thinker in residence, and Dr. Rüdiger Kresch, Director of Ethics, Equity, Trade and Human Rights with the World Health Organization. Welcome to both of you, and I'll have some more formal introductions shortly. Once again, the Press Club would like to thank our corporate and media sponsors for their continued support. Their generosity helped us with our recent media awards, recognising and rewarding excellence in journalism. And judges had to deal with close to 200 entries, which was a record. And prizes were presented at a highly successful awards night a couple of weeks ago, and would also like to thank the government for its contribution to the award scheme. Now, representing some of our sponsors today, we have Kim Rogers from Telstra, Peter Campbell from law firm Kelly & Co, and Jeff Timms from Timms Manufacturing Jewellers. Also joining us today is the member for Waite and Press Club regular Martin Hamilton-Smith and Senator Penny Wright. We're enjoying wines and beers from two of our other sponsors, Jacobs Creek and SA Brewing. And they're providing some of the prizes in today's raffle. On your tables, you'll find the raffle tickets, $3, $4, $5. So in addition to the beer and the wine, there's a $300 voucher to be won from Tim's Manufacturing Jewellers. Now, the Premier can't join us for our meal, but he'll be here shortly, and that's when I'll return to introduce our speakers. So enjoy your meal. Thank you. Excuse me again, ladies and gentlemen. Just a quick reminder about those raffle tickets there for $3 for $5, and also your mobile phones, please, too, if you could put them on silent. The 19th century British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli once said, "The health of the people is really the foundation upon which all their happiness and all their powers as a state depend." Of course, that still rings true today. But ensuring that good health is everyone's right, regardless of their circumstances, is the great challenge facing governments and communities across the world. The social determinants of health are the conditions in which people are born, grow, live, work, and age. And these conditions are, of course, shaped by the distribution of money, power, and resources. Concerned about widening inequities in health, the WHO established the Commission on Social Determinants of Health in 2005 to provide advice on how to reduce that gap. The most recent World Conference was held in Brazil last month. In Adelaide last week, the state government convened a summer school on health in all policies. 32 senior policymakers and academics from all corners of the globe attended, including Afghanistan, India, the Americas, Mongolia, and Malaysia. Building on the outcomes from Brazil, they agreed that after a lot of talk and many, many plans, it's time for action, and they've returned home with a joint commitment to act. So what does all this mean for South Australia? Well, please welcome Premier Jay Weatherall, who I believe is going to address one of the most important determinants of health, early childhood education. Premier Jay Weatherall.
Well, thank you very much. And perhaps to quote another Disraeli quote, I have climbed to the top of the greasy pole. So I'm very privileged to be here to address you on this incredibly important topic. Can I begin by acknowledging Dr. Rüdiger Kresch, Director of the Department of Ethics, Equity, Trade and Human Rights, the World Health Organisation, Professor Ilona Kickbush. Welcome back to South Australia. Thank you so much for all the wonderful help you've given us to understand this topic over the years. Ilona is, of course, Director of our Global Health Program, the Graduate Institute in Geneva's Global Health Program, and, of course, a former thinker-in-residence here in South Australia. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, well, we gather today on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people, and we acknowledge their spiritual relationship with their country. And in doing so, it's probably worth acknowledging that if there is a more profound example of the importance of a broader view of health and well-being an individual, it could not be said to be more profoundly expressed than in the plight of our Aboriginal peoples. Their disconnection from their spiritual connections with their land have a profound effect on their health and well-being. And I think if anybody looks back at the historical record, they'll see that in the very early years of the settlement of this colony, just in the early days, there will be descriptions of the local Aboriginal population that looked like they could have been written last week. And it was because of the very early disconnections that occurred between Aboriginal people, their spirituality, their land, the dispossession they suffered, it had an immediate effect on their health and well-being and has been replicated, sadly, throughout the ages. But I'm here to address this important topic of our health and well-being of our community. And, of course, in South Australia, we have the highest hopes and aspirations for our community. We want it to be a prosperous, fulfilling and sustainable community for all of our citizens. But to achieve those goals, at the heart of it, we will need healthy South Australians. And health cannot be considered as just one aspect of our lives. Profoundly, it is the foundations on which all is built. And we're lucky. Australians generally have good health. We are consistently rated amongst the top countries in the world on a range of indicators like life expectancy, Our health system is held in high regard internationally, recognised for its responsiveness and its equity. And it's only when you look at some of the advanced countries in the world grappling with some of the debates around their health system, the United States in particular, I think they must look over at envy at a system that we have here in Australia, which provides an important level of responsiveness and equity to our citizens. And here in South Australia, in a world-class health system, we are proud to have an excellent health system within that national context right here in South Australia. But we also know, despite having an excellent health system, that the benefits of good health are not shared equally. Governments of all persuasions have long accepted that there are profound differences when it comes to health and well-being. We've known for a long time that people on low incomes, for instance, on average less healthy. However, in more recent times, we've also seen dramatic improvements in the treatment of diseases. And what that's allowed to us, as we've washed out those effects, we've allowed to us to see more clearly the social determinants of health. And that's something that Alona has assisted us to understand in more detail in our particular South Australian context. Income is, of course, one of these, but so are people's social networks, their level of education, their gender, their culture, their working conditions, and their physical environment. And as the relative burden of acute disease diminishes, these are increasingly the elements that play a crucial part in determining people's health. So as a government, these are the areas where we should focus our efforts if we want to improve the health of our citizens. And we've come to realise that focusing on single risk factors such as cholesterol consumption or tobacco smoking, while very important, it's not enough if we're to meet the health needs of our communities in the 21st century. And while technological and medical developments have made enormous advances in our treatment of ill health, they alone won't solve our most pressing challenge. And that challenge is prevention, encouraging and maintaining health before treatment of illness and chronic conditions is necessary. If we want to realise the benefits of healthier individuals and a healthier society, then we need to pay attention to all aspects of people's lives. We need to understand that, and I quote, health is created in the context of everyday life where people live, love, work and play, from the Ottawa Charter, which I think is quoted by you, Alona, in one of your books. But of course, knowing this is one thing, acting on it is another. There's no doubt that influencing the social determinants of health is one of the most complex challenges for modern governments. The first thing that we must act on is the understanding that the responsibility for the health of South Australians is not just a matter for the Department of Health. Rather, it should be supported across government through agencies as diverse as justice, planning, housing and further education. This is the understanding that understands South Australia's health in all policies model. But saying whole of government, which I'm sure we've seen written in government documents since the 1990s, I think, and doing it is a profound challenge. It's a profound challenge for a Westminster system of government where all of the accountabilities run from the minister, as it properly should, through their various agencies. Working across those agencies, shared accountabilities, the shared application of resources is an incredibly difficult matter and challenges all governments of all persuasions in all countries. What we need, of course, is a commitment to that whole of government objective. If we act to support health in all of our work, if all agencies understand how their policies and services influence health, then we have our best chance of preventing illness and chronic health conditions. And we have our best chance of a healthy and productive state. Now, we've chosen one particular area for focus. Recently, obviously, I'm now in my new role, but one of the first things we did was to establish a new cabinet with new portfolio responsibilities. And a focus of our attention was early childhood development and the context of child development more generally. I believe that there's no more important area to act on this understanding that the focus of health must be incorporated across all of our work than in this area of early childhood. In fact, it's early childhood that will perhaps best test our capacity to provide health for all, because it's the support we provide in a person's early life that has the biggest impact on their lifelong health and happiness. And when I talk about the support that's provided to young people at that time in their life, I'm also talking not just about the things we do as government directly for those children, but for all of the agencies that affect all of the people that are involved in the lives of those children. So in this context, adult services that affect parents who have young children are as important as the services we provide directly to the children. Our mental health care services, our drug and alcohol services, the things that sustain the adults in families of young children are as profoundly important as the services we provide to children. In our health system, the Women's and Children's Hospital has always understood this. In fact, there's a lovely image which describes the Women's and Children's Hospital, which if you haven't looked at it closely, you'll see the face of the mother and a reflected vision of the face of the child. So this notion of seeing the child and the mother as one mirror image of the other in this context is at the heart of the work of our health system. But it's this understanding that needs to be brought more broadly into all of our work involving young children. And we've seen some startling research. It's relatively recent, but well understood by researchers, but I don't think well understood by the broader community. The neurological research confirms that every aspect of the first years of a child's life has a profound impact on a child's future. And not just their learning trajectories, but their health trajectories. The things that occur in those early years are setting up a child for the rest of their life in every respect. The adult that they will become will be profoundly affected by the child that they are in those early years. We know that babies and young children, development takes place in stages, and that there's a very real risk that a child will never reach their full potential if they're not supported through these crucial times. We know that these things can be recovered, but it often requiring resources tenfold the amount that would be needed if they were dealt with at the time. And the truth is we live in a system where there are constrained resources. So often this will be a choice about not remedying these issues, not overcoming these developmental deficits. Children's health and safety, their family networks, the environment they live in, the opportunities they have for learning and play, it's impossible just to pull out one thing that holds the key to the early years, or even to separate the many influences on a young child that support their healthy development. And it's not just each of these influences on their own and the effect they have on a child's development, it's the interplay between them. We know that the complex structuring and wiring of a child's brain in those early years is profoundly affected by the stimulation of all of their senses and often simultaneously. So all of these things have a profound effect on the way in which a child develops. The importance of a strong foundation for life is matched only by the complexity in providing the right services. But if we get this right, if we establish the right services and provide the right support, then we have the best chance to overcome entrenched disadvantage and improve our state's prospects and the health of our citizens. So this is simultaneously a social agenda and an economic agenda. This is the single most important thing we can do to overcome disadvantage, but it's also the single most important thing we can do to lift the prosperity of our state and our nation. As the Economic Development Board has noted, investing in early childhood is critical to the state's long-term development and economic success. The best return on the investment of public funds is achieved by investing in the very young. But we don't invest in the young children simply to get value for money. We do it because it's the right thing to do, because as a society, we care deeply for our children and their future. And this society, this South Australian community, has led the world in so many ways in relation to early childhood. Some extraordinary pioneers in this field, Catherine Helen Spence, the Alyssas, the whole range of extraordinary women often who have led our achievements in this area. And that says a lot, I think, about the depth of the social capital that exists within this state of ours. But it's the capability of our citizens, as much as our economic investments, that will ensure our future prosperity and provide for a happy and just society. I believe that it is the greatest obligation of our government to help every South Australian to grow to their full potential. The idea that every one of us has just so much to offer if we can unlock the potential that lies within each and every one of us, that's the great resource that will create not only the sort of society we want to live in, but also an exciting and prosperous place to live. And our government has had a long-standing commitment to investment in the early years. In 2004, we introduced universal home visiting. That's the idea of families of newborns receiving a visit from a health professional in the child's first 6 weeks of their life. And imagine the surprise of the nurse when they walked into our living room and provided one of these services. We had a nice chat, but the nurse did get rather nervous when they worked out who they were interviewing. But it was fantastic to see it in operation. I learnt so much by experiencing it myself. And it's interesting. The nurse said that they ask a lot of very personal questions about essentially risk factors in the life of the child, the family. And the nurse was very concerned about this. She thought initially that this would be something that would be rejected by families. But what she found is that families were incredibly forthcoming about the sort of information that they supplied because they wanted help. Because it doesn't matter how difficult a family is in, how desperate a family is in the situation they're in, they want to get themselves organised to give their best possible start for their child. So you see incredible opportunities to get adults to change their behaviour. Often it's ignorance for parents that don't understand how to parent. Children, of course, aren't issued with an instruction booklet. And, you know, a lot of parents parent how they were parented. And for some, that hasn't been necessarily a good experience. So this is an incredibly important initiative. And the point of this initiative is to identify those families that need additional support, and they will receive a further visit, up to, I think, 31 additional visits over a few-year period. And that provides the support that many of those families who need that support are desperately seeking. It's this early contact that lets us know when families need that ongoing support to avoid the need for the social or health interventions that would otherwise be necessary at a later stage. And our focus must always be on family support. We've had systems which I think have become, in a sense, confined to the disciplines that they were set up to reflect. There's an interesting story about the beginnings of the Child and Youth Health Agency. Looking back on the historical records over 100 years ago now, the first Mothers and Babies, the Child and Youth Health Service, was actually run in one of our early free kindergartens. So at that time we had the coming together of preschool, the early kindergarten movement, and healthcare in relation to what was called the School for Mothers at that time. So in the same institution in this city. And it brought all of those things together. So the health, the education, the family support. Now what we would do, as over the ensuing 100 years, we've created disciplines around those things. You know, the social work profession, the nursing profession, the teaching profession. And somehow in that we've lost to some degree the connection with parents and the place where they can come. And so we've been giving some thought to the way in which we can grapple with that question. We have introduced one thing that we know is that getting the right support at the right time is absolutely crucial, not when we think families need that support, but when they need it and are able to access it. We know that good quality early childhood education and care can have a massively important impact upon the vulnerable and disadvantaged children in our community. That's why we introduced early preschool access for Aboriginal children and for those children under the guardianship of the minister, because we knew that those two groups were particularly developmentally vulnerable. We wanted those children to have the best start to their education, to make sure they hit the ground running when they start school. But as I said before, early childhood education is only one strand of support. And in 2006 and 2007, we were fortunate to have another great thinker in residence here in South Australia, the late Dr. Fraser Mustard. He came, and those of you who have met him or may have even worked with Fraser, knows that he has been a tremendous advocate for meaningful investment in the early years. And during his time here, Fraser argued passionately for high-quality early childhood development services and programs, the services that are essential to give future generations the skills they need to become confident, capable and productive members of our community. Fraser certainly captured our attention, and we redoubled our efforts to place child development at the centre of our work. He helped us to understand that this should be the organising principle for our work, the notion of a child's development, not necessarily their health or their education or the family support, but this overarching concept of their development. And so he explained to us that the best early childhood services were ones that were integrated. And as any parent will tell you, you can't separate a child's health from their development. You can't separate family support from their education. And our challenge is to construct our services so that they look like this, that builds the right links between vital early childhood services. And at the centre of this is our flagship initiative of the Children's Centres. Children's Centres, their long name is Children's Centres for Early Childhood Development and Parenting. Fraser insisted that we call them the long name. It's very hard to fit on a sign, but we've called them Children's Centres, and I'm sure he's looking down asking me to clarify what the long name is. But we've built and are still building these centres and provide healthcare, parenting support, childcare and early education in the one place. They provide the services that families with young people need in one easily accessible location. The integrated services at each site build strong connections between families and the centre, and the centre and the community. And one of we've been assisted by many great thinkers over the years, and another of them is Margie Wally, who runs Penn Green, a very important children's centre in Britain. It's a centre of excellence for that work in Britain. And she made the profound observation that there are not hard-to-reach families, there are just hard-to-reach services. And so at the heart of our children's centres is the importance of outreach to ensure that we have comforting and welcoming places so that families can come in, and in particular, not just women but men, fathers, making sure that these are welcoming places for everybody involved in parenting. I don't think we can overestimate the importance of integrating services and or its difficulty. We know there are different cultures in the way in which different professions operate. We know that there are bureaucratic issues about bringing these things together. We know that if we are to support parents to give children the best possible start, we need to get the right information and services to them at the right time. And focusing on one service at a time will mean that we'll miss our chance to do this. For example, if a parent brings their six-month-old child in for a health check and all that's assessed is the child's physical milestones, then we've missed our opportunity to pass on a message that reading and talking to babies is a really important part of their development. And if, as certainly many of you would have experienced, if you're off in those prenatal classes and all they're talking about is how to change a nappy or how to involve the feeding of the child, as crucial as that is, we've lost other opportunities to talk about the profound effects of sending those messages to children in the early years. And if our four-year-old finishes preschool without a physical check, then we may have missed our chance to identify a hearing or a sight problem that could be difficult to manage later. So this understanding has informed our regular health and development checks for some time, as any parent holding a blue book will tell you. But with the children's centres, we've taken the integration of services to a new level. They are places that not only provide services but can demonstrate a whole new approach to to parenting for families who may never have had a good example to learn from. And for any parent that has young children, we just have so many blind spots. Often you'll see how another parent parents, and that will provide you with a strategy for dealing with something that seems like an intractable problem, like wrestling a screaming four-year-old in the middle of a shopping centre. I've seen some fantastic strategies for that I've learnt from. Quite useful for cabinet as well. They are becoming a community hub, a place where parents can go for the services they need and the support that can make a huge amount of difference for the whole family in the early years. But the integration of services shouldn't be limited to our children's centres, as important as they are. We want to go further. So we've now undertaken a radical rearrangement of the government agencies that provide services to children to take this integration and to roll it out on a much grander scale. For the first time in this country, all of the agencies responsible for supporting and caring for our children are being brought together under a single portfolio focused on child development. Education is the engine that drives equity, and it's a recognised social determinant of health. South Australia has a strong education system that gets good results on an international scale. Its focus is on the development of our children, which is why it was an ideal location for the newly integrated Child Development Agency. We can use education and the fact that it touches the lives of almost every South Australian from preschool all the way through to high school as the vehicle for the provision of joined up services. But placing early childhood education, care, health and social support services together in the same ministerial portfolio is about more than recognising the importance of education. At the heart of this reform is the devotion of our resources to provide support for all parents, children and young people from a common base, no matter what their family situation may be. Families under stress and children at risk need more support and possibly intervention, but they should not be separated out, hived off to a separate department, away from the agencies that provide services to all. Instead, every family should know that there is one focus of government and one minister that's dedicated to the well-being of their children, both in an immediate sense and across the life course. And, of course, things change. Things change for your family. You can be in a situation where you may not feel that there's a call for specialist services, but that could suddenly change with a diagnosis for your child. Needs also vary from family to family, but all of our families must know where to go to get the support that helps them when they need it most. Ladies and gentlemen, a lot rides on our ability to get this right. If we do, then South Australia will be a healthier society, but we'll also be a more productive and happier society, and we'll have less need to provide support for those citizens amongst us who are struggling. But most of all, we'll benefit from knowing that all South Australian children receive the support and care they deserve to be the very best they can be. Ladies and gentlemen, they'll grow up in that way to be happy, healthy adults, and South Australian community will be all the better for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Premier. Our next speaker is Professor Ilona Kickbush, who's had a distinguished career with the World Health Organization and is respected internationally for her contributions to innovation in public health, health promotion and global health. Her list of achievements, publications and clients is truly remarkable. As I mentioned earlier, she was a thinker in residence here 4 years ago when she helped formulate new approaches to health. Please welcome Professor Kickbush.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Premier. Lovely to see you again. It's indeed been an enormous privilege to be thinker in residence, and I can't even think of that in the past tense because I have this feeling once a thinker, always a thinker. And it's been wonderful to come back over the last 5 years to see how things have come to fruition, how things have developed, how new elements that came to those factors that I was looking at and have created new energy to move the agenda that I was asked to look at forward. And that was quite an agenda. I was asked to look at no less than healthy societies. And I was truly envious of a number of other thinkers who had, you know, much more concrete and manageable factors to look at. Also, I believe I had the largest group of partners that a thinker ever had, about 15, which didn't make it easy, but which was at the same time a reflection of the interest of many different groups in South Australian society who wanted to be involved in a new type of health agenda. And while we were thinking about how to approach this issue of healthy societies, one thing became clear, that I was not the thinker in residence, but the talker in residence. Because continuously, and that is part of a public health that tries to generate interest in health and common direction, is that you actually meet with people, that you hear what they are interested in, that you then bring your health agenda on the table, and that then you try and find a way to say, is there something where we both can benefit from? And this is the approach we chose when I was here in 2007, actually also at one stage in parallel with Fraser Mustard. And we had a lot of discussions how much child health was part of a health in all policies approach. And some of his thinking also entered the recommendations that I was able to put forward. When I came here, there was the strengthening of a movement around the world that had gained the title of Health in All Policies. It was actually built on thinking that had started earlier in the context of the World Health Organization, but actually also, as the Premier and others indicated, were the core of public health already in the 19th century. What actually makes people healthy? It's water and sanitation, it's housing, it's income, it's nutrition, it's above all access to education. And this got lost a bit in the 20th century when we were so focused on the progress of medicines, when we were building healthcare systems dedicated to curative care. And we are at a point now where societies are reshaping themselves so radically that we are actually rediscovering some of those major tenets. Because as we've heard, we cannot even dream of building health systems that would deal with all the problems we would have, particularly in terms of chronic disease and of mental health, if we do not start to address the determinants. But there's an additional agenda that has come up in that last decade, and that is not only our knowledge of determinants, meaning that this applies to each and every one of us, that, you know, factors like education, transport, housing, etc., influence our health, social capital influences our health, self-esteem influences our health. But that, as our societies have become more divided, we have started to understand that we need to make the equity agenda part of our determinants agenda. And we need to understand who is being left behind in health terms and who is not. And we are starting to see, even in countries just like Australia, that do guarantee access to health care, that that is not enough, that the equities have become so large that healthcare systems actually cannot balance them and compensate them. And if we look at the major challenges, mental health, children of lower social groups have nearly double the amount of mental health care problems than children of better off parts of the population. Children of the lower social groups have twice the level of obesity than other children. And you can go through any healthcare issue, be it from childhood right through to older age, and you find the very same pattern. And that means that we need to find ways and mechanisms where we can attempt some of that balance and where we can, while we guarantee on a universal level those general determinants of health, we all want bicycle parts, for example, but we need to be aware of the fact that even when bicycle parts are there, there are a number of people who can't afford a bicycle. And to be able to balance that and to be able to build policies around that is absolutely critical. So the approach we chose here during my residency was to speak with a whole range of other sectors and partners and work on this health in all policies approach, which now people increasingly call a whole of government approach, because we find a very fine shift has emerged. If we say health in all policies, it sounds as if we health people want to tell everybody else, you know, you've got to take health seriously no matter what. And we have learned over the years that actually what counts is to contribute to a common social goal. And therefore, as we were working here in South Australia, we took South Australia's strategic plan and actually analyzed it carefully and said, here is a whole set of goals. Can we show where health would allow other sectors to reach their goals? And can we show more clearly where other sectors are doing things like the education sector that will help health reach its goals? And how can we build a strategy around that? The result of that was twofold. On the one hand, a much greater interest, which has been upheld and strengthened over the last years, of the Department of Premier and Cabinet and ExCom in health, and a strategy within the health department and actually creating a unit that deals with health in all policies and that regularly works with other sectors on health lens analyses, as we have called it. And it is now, over the last 3 to 4 years, the health department has worked with 12 other departments and sectors across government to develop such health lens analyses and to find common purpose in health and well-being. That approach has been highly recognized at the international level, and that is one of the reasons we held the summer school here last week, because there had been so many questions and queries. How is South Australia doing this? How can we learn from this very concrete and tangible approach of working with other sectors, of being able to show co-production and co-benefits? And that has really allowed us to move forward quite considerably. And actually, one of the most recent such health lens analyses is with the colleagues in education, following through on some of the priorities that the Premier has just mentioned. So on an overall level, we are starting to understand, as the Premier has also said, that if we speak about health, we're not talking about a separate functional sector. We're actually talking about an overall goal of society. But because health has become so medicalized as a term, we say health policy, and what are we talking about? The financing of healthcare services. So that increasingly we now speak of a goal of health and well-being, and to be able to show both the interface of the physical and the mental health agenda, but also a larger agenda of people wanting to live well within their society. And the use of the term well-being is then also a term that allows partnership in a new way. That leads to another point, how the health in all policies agenda has moved forward, and I believe the meeting here today is a reflection of that. It's very clear that government can and must do certain things, that government must have an interest in governing better and governing more efficiently, and many such joined-up government initiatives are for that very purpose. But government can't do it alone, and the Premier also alluded to that. So increasingly in the international arena, we are speaking of a whole-of-society approach. How is it that other actors in society, private business, non-governmental organizations, shopkeepers, as much as football stars, start to get interested in the health and well-being agenda and help us promote that? And I was just saying at our table, one of the symbols of that for me was when I come here to South Australia, I always live near Rundle Street, and there's a newspaper agent where I go and buy my newspapers. And starting this year, what has happened there? Next to the cash register, he has a bowl of fruit. He's actually moved the fruit from the back of his shop to the front, saying on the one hand, more and more people are asking for it, but also having realized that this is what he wants to do. Now, you might think that's a negligent, very tiny thing. Who cares? The fact is, if, as the Premier said, health is created in everyday life, we need all those points. This is not rocket science. This is not, you know, having to have heart surgery with immense technology and resources. It's really making health the default option. We frequently say make the healthy choice the easier choice, but it's still not that easy always. And it should rather be the opposite way around, that the healthy choice is the normal choice, and that then we take a decision on a certain day that, you know, I'm really going to indulge now. And I think we all want and we all should do that. So this is also about a pleasurable life. So I believe the next stages in terms of the health in all policies approach here in South Australia is, on the one hand, going into even more depth into some very, very critical issues, and I do believe early childhood development is one of those, and we can see it rise considerably in the international agenda. I think bringing together the experiences gained through the health lens analyses, that, you know, that becomes not something special, but becomes the way of doing business within government. Whatever you do, you ask, what's its impact on the environment, on the economy, on health and well-being? And actually, within the European Union, that's an analysis, that's an assessment every major policy has to go through. And it's well worth thinking about doing that in a variety of ways. And the third is, I believe, a clear understanding that this needs a whole-of-society approach and that we all have a responsibility to help move the society towards health and to consider equity issues. This focus on equity is also something that's very, very tangible. And for me, one example is the whole area of health literacy. Frequently, we say, you know, people should know this. And we focus our efforts on educating people, which is obviously something we need to do. But we never really spend much time on thinking how readable our systems really are. We presuppose that people can read complicated systems like the healthcare system, like the school system, like the insurance system, as if it came like manna from heaven. But while our societies are getting ever more complex, we don't give people the tools and the means to actually deal with these complex societies. And the complex health issues that we deal with are definitely part of that. So it's been my great pleasure to be back yet once more in South Australia. I really look forward to our ongoing cooperation. You have heard that many of the people who were here at the course last week want to take this forward, continue to look to South Australia to help them resolve the very practical steps that need to be done. And I'd like to thank again the Premier and the Thinkers in Residence programme for having given me this enormous opportunity to work together with you over the last 5 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Kickbush. There will be hopefully some time for questions, for a few questions at the end of our luncheon. Our next guest speaker is Dr. Rüdiger Kresch, who, as I said earlier, is Director of Ethics, Equity, Trade and Human Rights with the World Health Organization. Previously, he held various other management positions with the WHO in the fields of health systems, policies, promotion and ageing. He said recently that the emphasis has shifted from the what and the why of inequalities in health to the how governments and communities can take decisive action to improve the delivery of health services across society. Dr. Kresch comes to us from the recent World Conference in Brazil. Please welcome Dr. Kresch.
Dear ladies and gentlemen, dear Premier, it's really a pleasure and an honour for me to be here today. And let me say how much I appreciated your talk to us, because it's not only what you said, but also how you say it. And I think we need leaders in the world who do this with a cool head and a warm heart. And so therefore, thank you very much for this. I would like to just outline a couple of things that are important to us, why and how social determinants of health action needs to take place. If I look at the situation here in Australia, you join the world with a lot of healthcare spending. I think about a third of your budget space is allocated to health care, and this percentage is on the increase, as in so many other countries. And only in about 10 years' time, we will be talking about perhaps half of the budget space being spent on health. And if you heard Professor Kickbush and also the Premier talk about the importance of other sectors contributing to health, or by perhaps what we could call bad actions deteriorate health, the budget space becomes more important because we want them to spend money on the right things. So the increase will come due to demographic trends, which you will find also in Australia. It will come through health technologies. It will come through caring for people with non-communicable diseases, and it will come through organization of the system itself. And there, I think we, coming from the healthcare and the health system itself, need to have a responsibility also in doing our homework well, because we know that not all health technologies bear with them the health impact that we would envisage. We also know that quite a lot of health interventions are inappropriate. About one third of all health interventions should not be done. And if you would look at the healthcare system as a business, we wouldn't survive, I guess. And so therefore, we need to do our homework. And when we then talk to other sectors, we need to be clear that we are doing the things right as well. So why WHO is so interested in Australia? And that is because people like you, but also because we see that you have systematically applied the experiences on health in all policies that Professor Kickbush was able to bring forward also here through her residency, but also as we see that you are serious about this, And the week last week, and also the seminar that we have today here, shows that people across states are interested in sharing this experience together with each other. And I hope that you will be able to also share your experience with other people in the world. There is health in all policies, approaches in Europe, and Professor Kickbush just mentioned Finland before. Yes, indeed. But the way you do it here is very particular. And whereas some things will work in other countries and other contexts, because politics is context-specific, of course, and how we can move forward in influencing decisions in other sectors to perhaps for joint goals and actions, so to really work across sectors for a broader societal goal. Some of the things would work in some countries and others will not. And we need to learn from each other why this is so. And so therefore, the way you've brought forward medical innovation, and you were talking about this, but also political innovation is quite something. And I just want to commend you on that. So sometimes it's like in the lighthouse. You don't see the light at the lighthouse. You would see it further out there. So sometimes it's good to also see that, yes, indeed, you bring the light to many other countries, and you should be aware of that. The how-to, and yes, indeed, we knew the what, and we knew the why we have to work on the social determinants of health. And Ilona said, you know, this has been the core of public health for so long. Yes, indeed, it has. And we now come to a much better understanding in our globalized world, which has become much more complex, perhaps, than 100 years ago. We need to better understand the how-to. And that means that we have to apply a systems approach. And there we share this way with our friends from the environmental decision-making processes. And I hope that as we speak, the negotiators at Durban will come up with tangible outcomes, because we need that for the survival of this planet. And so we need to apply the systems approach, that we look at the interconnections of the efforts that we're doing across government. We need to look outside of the health sector, and very often, again, we as public health professionals tended in the last decades to very much look internally and be very much medicalized. And we need to go back to our previous thinking in looking outside and seeing what the agendas in the transport sector are. What are the agendas in agriculture, in food industry, retail industry? We need to better understand that and tune in into those agendas with them, and then see whether we have joint other outcomes that also then would produce health. And we need to understand and act on the fact that health is socially produced. That is a fundamental knowledge, of course, that we have, and that we need to apply much more consistently in our policies. Altogether, we know that this is economically sound and good practice, and that's why we also have to do it. Of course, and we had this debate this morning, is to work on social determinants of health just an economic benefit, or is there something more? And I would say there is something more, because the right to health, to accessible health services, to affordable health care, is a human right, and it is a human right for everybody. And I'm very pleased that you look at the specific rights of young children in here in South Australia. So what does this mean to look at this health for young people? What does this mean with regard to the five action areas that the World Conference on Social Determinants of Health identified. It's about governance. And I'm very happy again to read the a weekend's newspaper because in there there was the cover story was the interconnectedness and collaboration between the educational and the health sector in school feeding. Do you know that so many children don't eat breakfast at home these days? This is very unhealthy. We know that cardiovascular diseases are steeply increased if children are not fed well in the mornings. But at the same time, we know that they can't learn well if they're not fed. If they have a hungry stomach, you don't learn well. And so therefore, I'm grateful that we have a good lunch here. So that means by organizing school feeding, 240 schools here in South Australia participate in that, and I would hope that all schools would participate in that in the future. Because some children coming from poor families will have less breakfasts at home, but not only poor children, but also children coming from two-income families who then say that they don't have the time to give breakfast to their children. Lots of education is important there, and you mentioned the parent education there. But also to have this joint collaboration then to have this at the school is important. Participation, to ask the parents what is important for your health of your children, to ask the children themselves what is important for you. And not only some, but to have a systematic approach to that is something that if you do that, you will see that with very few interventions, you will have very good outcomes. The health sector, I mentioned already, we need to be clear what is needed. Primary health care has proven to be the most cost-effective way of providing health services, and that means low-tech as much as possible. Not start with the high tech, start with the low tech, and then increasingly apply higher tech as appropriate. But start with the low tech and have a good interrelation between the GPs and the specialists. But start with the GPs in the first place. We need to act globally, and the right to of children to have access to affordable health services is a global right. Increasingly around the world, we see that out-of-pocket spending, so that means that you pay for the doctor when your child sees the doctor, or you pay the hospital when your child is admitted to hospital, that is on the increase. In some countries, we now have 60% of out-of-pocket spending. That is the contribution of the health sector to inequities, and that has to be reduced. I don't know what the figure here in Australia is, but what I know is that also you have rising out-of-pocket spending, and you may wish to look at that, because that is not the answer to tighter budget space. And last not least, you want to monitor. You want to raise accountability, and that means that you want to see what are the healthy options that Ilona talked about in early child development. Make that the normal and make the unhealthy choice the abnormal decision. But therefore, we need to be clear about what the likely consequences of policies in transport or housing are on children's health. We know that in Australia, more and more people in the housing sector, when you build your house, you prioritize the space of the house. And you have less and less backyards where children were able to play. Now, in Sweden, that has caused, amongst others, a 15% of decrease of physical activities in the last 15 years. That is because we use the remote control for the TV, we use the elevators instead of the stairs, but as well, we will jump into the car instead of walking to the next bus station. So all of this plays together and for a decrease in physical activity, which has an, as an effect, an increase in obesity rates in children. And also, I commend you on your latest law that you will put the calories on the McDonald's burgers and to see how much you actually spend on that. So there's lots of us to do together there. Health is a seismograph, and with that I come to the end. Health is a seismograph immediately. The financial crisis in Europe has immediately caused a 13% increase in suicide rates in Spain and a 17% increase of suicide rates in Greece. So it's not only that we can see the lag time consequences 5 years after, but we can immediately see a bad policy that was triggered by greed and where we in the health sector now have to bear with the consequences. We can see this straight away. And with this, I come to the end. I'm really grateful to being here. Look forward to a discussion. Thanks.
Yes, the Premier has to leave us now. Thank you again, Jay Weatherall, for speaking to our function today. Now, there is a bit of time for, only a little bit of time for some questions. There is a microphone there at the back of the room. So Professor Kickbush and Dr. Kresh would welcome some questions if there are any, please. No questions. I think you must have covered all the points. Okay, well, after hearing from our speakers today, it's clear that health is the single most important measure of our priorities and our social conscience. Indeed, someone once said, without health, life is not life. So there is enormous expectation on health professionals to act before their next major global meeting in Helsinki in 2013. So please thank our speakers today, Professor Ilona Kickbush and Dr. Rüdiger Kresh. I hope you can find some space in your hand luggage to take back some samples of some local red wine. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is beautiful.
Thank you, so thank you very much. Okay. Now, we'll get on to the raffle in a moment, but just looking ahead to a couple of functions that are coming up, which you might like to put in your diary. For all the cycling fans and even those who just wish to be entertained, Graham Gilbertson from Channel 9 here, I'm sure you'll be one of the first to book for this one. January 16, Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin are here for the Tour Down Under. They've spoken to us, I think this might be their fourth time. And if you haven't been to one of their luncheons, you must really come. They are very entertaining, very lively discussion, anecdotes, recounting their experiences on the various tours around the world. It is one of the better speeches and the better talks that you will go to. So I please ask you to consider the Liggett Sherwin lunch on January 16. There are some booking forms out the front, or you can book in the next few weeks through the normal means. Now, also in January, one of our sponsors, Kelly & Co, the law company, they are hosting, and this is particularly relevant right now, of course, they are hosting a media privacy breakfast on, Wednesday, 11th of January. And given the public inquiry taking place in Australia at the moment, and also the one that you've no doubt all read about in the UK and the revelations that are coming out there, this could be particularly worthwhile. Now, Kelly and Co have invited, would you believe, a John Kelly, who's a leading privacy lawyer in the UK, and he will debate the merits of this issue. on Wednesday, the 11th of January, as I say, in the Kelly & Co boardroom for, as I say, a breakfast with a 7:45 start. Now, for those wishing to attend this one, please see our Secretary, Susan Karakousis, in the foyer afterwards. But that, yes, could be quite enlightening. Now, for the raffle, tickets would be... Jackie. Okay, now for the $300
Grant, I can't
voucher.
Be the only young woman in the room to be drawing the raffle tickets.
But you are the most attractive. Okay, now this is for the $300 Jeff Timms voucher.
And it's purple A2.
Purple.
No name, purple A2. Yes, here we have it.
Here we go. Now for the wine, there's a couple of bottles of wine there.
Red A84. Red A84, no name again.
Over there.
Over there.
And lastly, for the carton of beer.
Green B2, Klaus.
Cheers, that was the wine. A couple of bottles there and there.
Have we got? Yes, green B2.
Okay. Thank you again, ladies and gentlemen, for coming today and, as I said earlier, for supporting us during the year. And we'll see you in the new year, as I say, first up with that January 16 luncheon with Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin. Have an enjoyable Christmas. Thank you again.